Hi, I'm Chris.
I'm Nathan.
This is Rich.
And I'm Matt. I almost said it. I'm Stoes. And I'm Matt. Should we do that again?
No.
And together with our powers combined, we are the Tolkien Heads. The Lord of the Rings, Book 2, Chapter 9. The Great River.
Old Matt is a little tired.
Yeah, I guess. He's recovering from a cold. I guess that's an excuse. I don't know.
He's over here biting his nails like Boromir.
Yeah. I had a long day today. I've drunk a lot of coffee, and I taught three classes today, which was a first for me.
Yeah. That is impressive. It almost sounds like a full day's work.
I know. Are people sick?
Take lesson planning into account, and it was a lot of work.
Was it three different classes?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Three different semesters of a language.
Wow.
Fair enough.
Yep.
Fair enough.
Pretty cray.
Yeah, I think the kids are still saying that.
Yeah.
So, before we move on to the Great River, which is the chapter for this week, I realized that in our podcast last week, we did not talk about the phrase, the hyphenated phrase, after days from our Lectio passage last week.
Yeah, I was interested in the fact that nobody really touched that during the Lectio section, because I thought it was a pretty cool phrase or image that maybe went with it, but... Yeah. It reminds me of, you know, like post-apocalyptic, like after what? It sounds post-apocalyptic.
So Legolas says, "Alas for us all, and for all that walk the world in these after days." I took it to mean in the time after the waning of Lady Galadriel's power. And then, you know, the waning of the elves.
Yeah, that was sort of the context of the comment, right? They were talking about Lothlorien, I think.
They were leaving, yeah. Any other thoughts on that? What that might be in reference to?
I don't know. I thought maybe another meaning could possibly be just like in recent days or something. Kind of like how like the Mormons say like Latter-day Saints, like the latter days being like recently, you know? Like days of late.
Yeah, but is it also when you say the latter days, are you also talking about the what is going to be the last days?
That's kind of, yeah, maybe.
Is it also a reference to, like, after the fall?
So the after days or the latter days?
Yeah, the elves have been, well, some of them have been kicked out of paradise, as it were.
Mm. And the rest are going to have to leave at some...
And there is a time before days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, I like that interpretation, too. The fall.
Do we think... Tolkien saw the after days having already arisen in the real world?
Oh, maybe like the industrialization of Britain?
Yeah, or the world, World War One.
Yeah, death of all that 19th century optimism, maybe.
Yeah, I wonder when, maybe we should check when he first drafted that chapter.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause this was probably around the years 39, 40, 41.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. We should check on that. But
if you're somebody who's listening and you happen to know, drop us a line.
I had one more little thing, actually. I had forgotten it. Also on that 378, I just wanted to point out that all of the company was crying.
Mm-hmm.
And that, like, the company, like, in Tolkien's world, it's perfect. Like, these aren't stoic male heroes or whatever. Like, they show emotion, they cry.
They're more romantic.
Like, still be heroic that way in this, like, the Tolkien masculinity. And here they're not mourning, like Gandalf, like they were before, which they also wept for. But here it's just they've seen something really beautiful and leaving this place. Like, they're weeping for that.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Do you cry a lot, Stoes?
When the right song or movie is on, or like the right hymn.
Hmm. Okay. Cool. Well, Matt's on summary this week, and I take it he didn't do any preparation.
No, I didn't, because I just finished reading this chapter like 20 minutes ago.
Your dedication is amazing.
But, you know, let's just do this. They're floating down a river... Rolling, and
merrily, merrily, merrily.
Oh, I was doing a proud Mary thing.
Yeah, I know.
But
I was doing the adverb of Mary.
What happens, oh. Matt?
Well, there's a white figure following them, and one night Frodo brings it up to Aragorn because he's worried, and Aragorn is like, "Ah, I see you found Gollum," and Frodo's like, "Ah, so that is Gollum." So, so that's the thing that happened. Mm-hmm. Gollum is there,
mm-hmm.
And later in the chapter, basically they're going down this river the whole time. Legolas shoots down something,
mm-hmm.
or shoots something down, if you're of that persuasion. And that I sort of forget the details about that, but they thought it was dangerous, and it sounded like they killed it, whatever it was. So that's good. And then Aragorn and Boromir are arguing over which way to go. I think Boromir wants to go south towards Gondor.
He wants to go to Minas Tirith, yes.
And Aragorn does not want to go that way. And I think Aragorn wins the War of Wills.
It's not clear if he wants to go that way.
Well, I don't know if he's
way,
won yet.
Or if he's just, like, being contrarian.
Boromir? Or
no,
Aragorn.
Aragorn.
Yeah.
I don't think he knows.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. That it? We're done?
Well, they encounter some rapids. They choose to go Aragorn's way.
Yep.
And that's all that I remember.
Cool. Any other details, y'all?
Well, Aragorn, they pass these cool statues.
Right.
Right.
The Argonauts.
Yeah, which show the figures of, who is it? Isildur and Anarion?
Yes.
So, his sires of old. And mm-hmm. and everyone else is kind of cowering because the water is going quickly, and they look really imposing and scary, but Aragorn just defies the wind and the waves and looks noble in the boat and is ready to come home and excited to be in Gondor again.
To be fair, he looks noble to Frodo, right? So it is, it could be that he looks no different to anyone else, but perhaps that Frodo has this seems like gift of perception beyond sight.
Maybe. He's also in the same boat as Aragorn. So the others maybe can't see it. Or it doesn't look that impressive from their angle.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, but
Frodo's right next to him.
So. My guess is that he doesn't actually look any different.
Oh.
No, well, yeah, right.
Well, maybe
he sounds confident or something. I understood it.
Yeah, he perceives him to be different.
Yeah.
And it's almost like, I mean, we can talk about it later, but it's almost like the statues reminded Frodo of Aragorn's, you know, kingliness or something.
I think it's the other way around. The statues reminded Aragorn of his kingliness.
And then Aragorn's demeanor reminded
Frodo. I don't know.
Frodo of,
and then Frodo perceived that change in demeanor.
I'm going to be contrarian without being querulous, hopefully.
Oh, he already dropped, well,
very
I don't.
Nice. Very nice.
Drop the cue bomb.
No. I don't think you're using that correctly. Querulous is the word of the podcast, and it means complaining in a whining manner. I think you meant quarrelsome.
I'm not complaining, but I'm whining.
Okay. He said without being querulous.
Yeah, but I think he meant without being quarrelsome.
All right, okay, so sure. In the language section...
Are you being querulous right now?
I'm being quarrelsome.
Okay. They do get attacked by orcs, though.
Yeah,
oh, right,
it's
right,
not
right.
All that
is that the same time
though.
when he shoots down the thing? Or no?
Yes.
Right before
like,
that.
Okay,
right,
that's kind of the same scene.
I mean, Frodo gets hit with an arrow. But
two, I think.
He's wearing the mithril coat,
oh my
so
God.
He doesn't get affected.
I skimmed right over that.
It hits someone else in the hat. Was it Aragorn?
The hood.
The hood, yeah.
Aragorn's hood.
And gets near someone's hand.
Yeah.
Sam's?
Mary's hand.
Okay.
But yeah, so they're afraid of the eastern shore because it appears to be held by orcs,
which I think is on the left.
That as they're going down the river, it would be on the left because they are generally moving south
in a southerly direction.
Yeah, so that's all fascinating, you know. Tidbits. All
right, that's 7 minutes.
We
on
can edit out like 60% of the podcast so far.
Okay, Matt, language.
We're gonna need every second of this.
All right, so. You guys know that I'm kind of interested in, like, meta talk on language, I guess, or language, like, talking about language as it occurs in the book. So last chapter we saw where, was the last chapter or the one before? I don't remember. I think the last one where Galadriel gives Sam this box and it's got like the G rune on it. And she's like, well, it's G for Galadriel, but it can be G for Garden too, Sam. And I thought that was pretty cool. And we have something, we have some more Sam talking about language. It's usually Sam for some reason, or it's frequently Sam, on our page 382, where Sam is recalling this dream that he had. And he said, I had a funny dream an hour or two before we stopped, Mr. Frodo. Or maybe it wasn't a dream. Funny it was, anyway. And then Frodo is just in, like, a certain mindset that he's just, like, and he just really mournfully says, well, what was it? And then he's thinking, like funny, like, what could be funny? I haven't seen or thought of anything to make me smile since we left Lothlorien. And he just assumes that Sam meant the usage of funny that means, like, it made him smile or it made him laugh or something. And that's not at all what Sam meant.
Do you think Frodo thinks that, or do you think he's just sort of being, like...
He's, like, assaulting Sam for even bringing up, like, fun?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Or something, yeah.
Yeah, he's in a mood, anyway. And Sam's like... It wasn't funny that way, Mr. Frodo. It was queer. So it was funny in the sense of, like, strange. Mm-hmm. But I thought that this little interplay was funny.
Did you laugh?
I did. I thought it was funny in both ways.
Okay.
So, but I don't know what more to make of that. Mm-hmm. But basically, Frodo is just in this mood where he... Funny has two meanings, and he picked one based on, like, what he was thinking of at the time. Or, like you said... Maybe, like, to pick a fight with Sam, just because maybe Sam can be annoying sometimes, and Frodo just, like, had it with Sam's Samness, you know?
Right. Well, Sam's in a boat right now, and he's probably not at his peak performance. He could be very well being annoying right now.
Yeah, he's probably doing better than Boromir.
Sam doesn't like boats, right? Mary's okay with them, but Sam...
Yeah.
Sam is really uncomfortable in a boat.
Distrustful.
He doesn't like fog either. He just, like, pretty much doesn't like anything.
Sam likes a lot of things. Just
he likes the earth.
Yeah, he likes having his feet on terra firma.
Gardening and potatoes and beer.
Yes.
All right. So further on, I don't know what to talk about next. All right. So not further on, but the page before, we're talking about the landscape here and what all, you know, the evil one or the shadow has done to the landscape, and we hear about how the orcs have been cattle raiding, right?
They're horse thieves.
Well, they're also cattle. So this is Rohan they're talking about. The orcs have dared to cross the water and raid the herds and studs of Rohan. So the orcs are coming to steal the livestock of Rohan, which is a very common trope in... Indo-European mythology, Indo-European being like this sort of overarching, like sort of background of, say, Greek mythology and Celtic mythology and Germanic mythology. The idea of a cattle raid or like a livestock raid is super common in old European myths. And I'm sure Tolkien was drawing from that. So in the Irish tradition, for example, there's the famous prose saga, the Tan Bo Cuilinge, the cattle raid of Cooley, where the hero, Cuchulainn, has to, like, defend the big, like, whatever magical bull from being stolen from the other people. And then there's a really interesting etymology for the word Cyclops, which comes to us from Greek. A lot of people think the origin of this word used to be, or people used to think that it was, like, cyclo, like a circle or round, ops, eye, like circle eye, because they have like one eye and that eye is a circle or whatever that would mean. But a much more compelling etymology for Cyclops has been proposed in recent decades, and that is that the historical form of it would have had, or earlier had a p sound in front of it, so Puku Klops. Puku is the Indo-European word for cattle, and Klop is like an agent noun that means like a stealer, basically, or a thief. Mm-hmm. So a monster that comes and steals your cattle. It has nothing to do with its however many eyes it has. So orcs are sort of like the mythological cyclopses or cyclopes in this example. That's what it is. On a similar tack as like sort of comparative mythology, on 385 we see this thing where Legolas sees an eagle flying or something, or it's a hunting eagle, or what do they say? Anyway, and they're trying to divine what sort of sign the eagle is. And we don't see too much about their, like, superstitions or mythologies or anything. And this was a really kind of cool example that maybe they have this tradition of, like, studying the flight of birds, as in ancient and medieval Europe.
Auspices.
Taking the auspices, yeah. So mm-hmm. looking at a part of the sky and, oh, whatever kind of bird is doing, you know, this or that can inform, you can make predictions about the future. And they're trying to figure out whether this is a good or bad sign.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was kind of cool.
Oh, I took it more for just like, oh, we're being watched, but less. But yeah, I wonder what that forebodes. I think, yeah, it may not augur well for them. That's true.
It may not. I think there's definitely an element of foreboding, yeah.
And it's not the first time that they've looked to the sky, something moving in the sky, and tried to, you know, make predictions based on what they see. They had the cribine.
Right, yeah.
Remember a few chapters ago?
The raven-like things.
Actually, that was...
Or crow-like things.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was pre-Lorien, I think. Or pre...
Right. That was around the Misty Mountains.
Yes.
After they left Rivendell. And
yeah.
They, in this chapter, there's also a flock of black swans that's moving. And they're, I think, both awed by the swans, but also somewhat wary of them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah,
I think we should be wary, or we should look out for things like this in the future. Spies. Mm.
Sorry, Stoes, did you say it may not augur well?
Yeah.
I thought an auger was a noun with a spiral-shaped coil in it.
No, like there's also an augury. It has to do with like reading the signs of the birds.
Oh.
Right.
Okay.
I was being clever.
I see.
Clever in the pejorative sense.
I was playing on the words.
Fair enough. Okay.
That was a funny thing to say. Well, that's it for me.
And I think it's it for Stowe's as well. There's no...
I have no song to sing.
Well, he can say stuff.
Round land.
I think he's got first dibs on general discussion.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Nate, is there any landscape in this chapter?
Oh my god.
No. None.
None, yeah.
No, we were chatting before the show, and these guys suggested just giving me the chapter because that's kind of all there is. But strangely, there's not a lot to say about this. I mean, what did you guys think of it? It was just, it's kind of boring, isn't it?
But I think more than any other, like, you've talked about, like, how war has, like, brought destruction on the landscape. But, like, the Brownlands, like, more, like, is the cult... if not the culmination, like, this is more so than anything we've seen. Nothing is even growing there, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's what I want to kind of focus on from all of this stuff. I guess there are some somewhat nice, you know, there are some nice descriptions and poetic descriptions of the, I guess, kind of fluvial or riverine environments.
Mm-hmm.
And some pretty precise descriptions of, like, what it is like to go down a river. You know, if you've ever done this, it takes constant vigilance, actually, and you have to be, like Sam, you have to, you know, be aware of all the little shoals.
You have to hang on for dear life while others are doing the work.
Yeah, well, you need someone to do it.
Yeah.
So you need a lookout, basically.
And they had to, like, portage at one point, and they had to make, like, multiple trips.
Yeah, they had
trips,
to make a portage.
And... there was clearly a lot of attention that went into, you know, Tolkien calculating exactly how hard it would be for them to go, you know, that distance with so many people.
And the landscape changes a great deal,
the
right?
The landscape does change quite a big deal. They cover quite a bit of ground.
Yeah.
Of course, they're moving on... So they're moving with the current of the river, which flows south. And so they're able to make up, you know, they're able to cover quite a bit of distance in this chapter. And I think it's like 10 days
that's covered in this
chapter. But you know, they don't have to fight the current. And they don't have to fight their own weary legs. They, you know, they can... So it's kind of a respite for
them.
And,
yes, Aragorn, it's mentioned that he's husbanding everyone's strength.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. While he's trying to figure out what the hell to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Husbanding means to use scarcely or to sort of, like, steward... or shore
nurse.
Up. To nurse means to bring
like
back
like
to...
if you're nursing a drink.
Mm.
Yes. Would that be like husbanding?
Yeah, perhaps, yes.
Yeah, so he's like the caretaker. But anyway, if you look on the first page of this chapter, page 380, but actually one of the words, it was quite striking. I think the word that maybe appears the most frequently, other than like just very common words like the and stuff, is gray.
Hmm.
I don't know if you guys noticed. It's like some sentences it appears like two or three times in the same sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So he's really emphasizing the fact that these lands are pretty boring.
Yeah, well, he made the point well.
And maybe it's just because they just came out of Lorien, and so everything in comparison looks dull and gray. But if you look on page 380, we get a good example of this. It's maybe two-thirds down. As the third day of their voyage wore on, the lands changed slowly. The trees thinned and then failed altogether. On the eastern bank to their left, they saw long, formless slopes stretching up and away towards the sky. Brown and withered they looked, as if fire had passed over them, leaving no living blade of green. An unfriendly waste without even a broken tree or a bold stone to relieve the emptiness. They had come to the brown lands that lay, vast and desolate, between southern Mirkwood and the hills of the Emun Muil. What pestilence or war or evil deed of the enemy had so blasted all that region, even Aragorn could not tell. The brown lands, the history of this region is actually, we'll find out more of this later when we get to Fangorn Forest. This was an area inhabited by the Entwives, so we'll talk more about the Ents later, but basically the Ents and the Entwives are living, talking, moving, intelligent, tree-like peoples.
And
caretakers, stewards, husbands.
Yes, stewards of the forests.
Husbands of the forest.
Apparently, the Ents and the Entwives at some point had a fundamental disagreement about how that stewardship of their land needed to occur. Mm. We'll talk about this more later, but basically the Ents favored more allowing the forest to sort of be its wild self, and the Entwives favored a more interventionist, cultivationist philosophy. And so they
shiring,
exactly. So they prefer gardens and flowers and cultivated spaces, where the Ents prefer wild forest. And so there's a schism, basically, and the Entwives leave, and they inhabit this region east of the Great River, and they turn it into this beautiful landscape of gardens, essentially. But at the end of the Second Age, there's a massive war between Sauron and his enemies, the elves, and men. There's an alliance between these people, and basically, Sauron and his forces lay waste to these lands and turn it into this barren wasteland. We're not exactly sure what happened here, if there's some kind of chemical pollution or...
Sounds like scorched earth policy.
Scorched earth, yeah. But, I mean, we're talking several thousands of years later, and it's still completely barren and uninhabited. And the brown lands, Tolkien wrote in another place, in an index that he wrote, it is actually a translation into Westron English from a Sindarin word, Benenur, which means brown or golden brown land. Okay. And it actually has the same root as another word we've seen in this book, the Barandwin, which is the Brandywine River, which means like golden brown river. And in that case, this element of like brown or golden brown got translated into something that was like very familiar for the inhabitants of that region, hobbits, being beer or, you know, alcoholic beverages.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, it gets translated into just brown lands, which, you know, doesn't have a very positive valence. It's actually pretty negative connotation. But the similar etymological element, I think, is intriguing, because it shows that, like, you know, this, maybe there's a connection between, like, the hobbits are people that also like this kind of shiring, cultivation, gardens, flowers, plants and stuff, just like the Entwives. And, you know, this area was destroyed, and, you know, maybe there's some kind of a connection there. You know, this could happen anywhere, sort of thing.
Maybe these brown lands didn't have to be, like, brown in a bad way. Maybe they could have been, like, the golden brown,
yeah,
in a more positive way that the Brandywine mm-hmm. is. But the case is that it's that they're desolate now.
Yeah. Yeah, so you could imagine, like, golden brown plants as being, you know, very a very beautiful place if they were actually growing here. But here we have nothing. Mm-hmm. Then on the next page, and then I think I'll quit, but page 381, you get more of this stuff. This is toward the bottom of the page. The bank slid by. Soon the river broadened and grew more shallow. Long stony beaches lay upon the east, and there were gravel shoals in the water, so that careful steering was needed. The brown lands rose into bleak wolds, over which flowed a chill air from the east. The word wold here, I think, is used intentionally. The word basically means it's a wooded, forested area.
When you say he used it intentionally, you mean like he intentionally used a word that might not be readily understood by most people, or not an everyday English word?
Not an everyday English word, and you know, when you read this, you might not know exactly what that's referring to. Mm. But here they're described as being bleak and barren, and in other places they're described as being treeless specifically, which is a direct contradiction to what the word actually means, wold. So for me, that means that, like, there's something that happened here. Like, if the place is known as a wold, this is actually part of northern Rohan, which is treeless. They are grasslands. But if it's known as the Wold, there, it must have been forested at some time in its past.
Mm.
So what has happened? Has it been deforested because of war? Is it just because the Rohirrim are horse masters? You know, they graze horses on these lands, and the horses keep the land open and treeless? Or is there something else more nefarious going on? The word Wold, it goes back to Old English, walled, or, and in modern German, it's Wald, so forest. The word means forest. So I just think it's a curious usage to describe a barren, treeless landscape, when obviously it Tolkien is. Knows exactly what this word means, and he knows the etymological history of it. But, you know, I think there's, again, an instance of the lands being broken somehow, and not inhabited and not being maintained properly.
I think it's like the bird, a sign, like all of these, the landscape, it's a sign, it's an ominous sign, like bad things are happening, we're outside of the lands of safety.
Mm-hmm.
This is like the warning chapter, maybe.
Yeah, and like the whole chapter, most of it is just like gray and barren, like we said, but and brown. They do it at the end, once they pass into the realm, well, the former realm of Gondor. Gondor no longer has a presence there, but they pass through these giant statues, and then they get to these hills, and they are covered in trees. So it's kind of like the presence of the people who live there, you know, has an impact on the kind of landscape and the landscape's health. For whatever reason, those hillsides remained forested. Perhaps they were better maintained, or, you know, they didn't fall under the same kind of evil that the Brownlands did.
Mm-hmm. I don't see it so much as a warning as a reminder, which perhaps you could argue would serve as a warning, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think so much about what Tolkien writes, and so much about the elves and even Aragorn, is about memory and remembering. And perhaps it's an indicator, but not a warning to the reader, that there is something perfidious at foot. So we're going to move on to Lectio, which Herostos does have for the week.
Indeed. And there's a word that is rather uncommon in English, and I looked it up, and it's spelled E-Y-O-T. Can be pronounced eight or iot, or I guess whatever you want. Multiple pronunciations are available online. So, Melecchio passage comes on page 383 at the bottom in our book. Sam is taking watch, and Frodo has told Sam to wake him up after a few hours. So this happens right after Frodo is woken up out of his deep, dark sleep, and then it's just Frodo alone keeping watch at night. So I'm going to start reading. He, so this is Sam, lay down, and Frodo sat up, huddled in his blankets, and fought off his sleep. Minutes or hours passed slowly, and nothing happened. Frodo was just yielding to the temptation to lie down again when a dark shape, hardly visible, floated close to one of the moored boats. A long, whitish hand could be dimly seen as it shot out and grabbed the gunwale. Two pale, lamp-like eyes shone coldly as they peered inside. And then they lifted and gazed up at Frodo on the iat. They were not more than a yard or two away, and Frodo heard the soft hiss of intaken breath. He stood up, drawing Sting from its sheath, and faced the eyes. Immediately, their light was shut off. There was another hiss and a splash, and the dark log shape shot away downstream into the night. It comes to me to do the literal. Frodo's keeping watch. He's really tired, and it's very boring. And he's just about to fall asleep when, there's a dark shape that comes. And he looks at this shape, and it has eyes. And then he draws his sword, and then the creature, whatever it is, dives away into the night.
So part of the literal is perhaps maybe what's left out, and notice that Sting is not glowing, or at least there's no mention of Sting glowing.
Good point.
So we can say that it's not an orc, right? It's orcs for whom?
Right, that's a good point. We know it's not an orc, it's some other creature, which we're about to name.
So, and then but
it's not named yet.
The other thing that's interesting to me is the fact that it's a dark shape, but it's a whitish hand with lamp-like eyes. You have contrast there, literally. So, is it Nate? Nate, you're on symbolic?
I'm on symbolic.
Yeah.
How about that? It shot out and grabbed the gunwale.
The gunwale?
Did he use the verb shot because of the proximity with the gunwale?
Oh, maybe. Gunwale is like the rim?
A gunwale.
That doesn't help me.
Yeah.
The rim around the boat.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
The upper edge of the side of the boat, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. For me, symbolically, Frodo is, he's trying to fight off sleep.
And perhaps like the rest of us were when reading this chapter.
Like, oh my god.
That's what I was going to say. Like,
too real.
Kind of like the reader at this moment, perhaps. No, that's a little harsh. But I think symbolic, I don't know how symbolic this is, but this just makes me think of traveling and how boring most of it is. And, you go into a trip perhaps very excited about the trip. I mean, they're probably not too excited about this because it's
certain death.
But there is a certain amount of, we'll say, objective excitement, right?
Yeah.
Like you excite an electron.
Right. And, like, they have had a lot of exciting moments.
Yes.
Or, at least something that could, get their hearts pumping a little bit. Here, we're in the portion of the journey where not much happens, and it's kind of a struggle just to maintain your focus. And I think
that's a very real part of the journey.
It is a very real part of the journey, but it's a part of the journey that you often don't think of. And when you go through it, it perhaps disappoints you, or you're like, well, it at least isn't something that you readily think of when you're preparing for the journey. Mm-hmm. You know, you think about how it's going to be once you get there to your destination, or once you achieve your task or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is like a hard thing to write, to create interest in a chapter like this, because like part of it I think is just functional, like we need to get down this river and we need to cover some ground. So how do you build interest from this? And it's like part of the way to do that, I think, is to attempt to create the feeling that you can't let your guard down. And like, you know, the temptation is just to kind of like take this moment to relax and just float your way down the river, but they're not out of danger.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's perhaps symbolically what's going on here. It's like the danger is hidden. It's under the surface. It's in the shadows. But you have to be constantly vigilant for the different kinds of dangers that you can see on this quest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about this the second time I think you've used the word vigilant. What about the word vigilante? You see, vigilant is a positive word, but vigilante is negative. Is it? Yeah. Vigilante justice?
Yes.
It's always negative.
I don't know that it's always negative, especially by people who perpetrate it. But I don't think it's inherently a negative term, but I think we have usually a negative opinion of it. But, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think Gollum is very vigilant and perhaps even a vigilante. I mean, he's on the run, right? I mean, he's on no one's side, right? Like, he's between these two camps.
He's showed a lot of skill just to track them,
right,
to this point.
Yeah, and Aragorn even says as much. He's very skillful or whatever, wary and whatever.
Slyer than a fox.
Yes, and I think we've met the fox, so
yeah,
you know.
The talking fox.
Yes. Yeah. The
this
whole chapter for the most part is very boring. It's like driving on the interstate,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then all of a sudden someone cuts into your lane and you're not like paying attention, or you like roll over into the rumble strip and you like sort of snap awake or whatever.
Something like tragedy can strike at a moment's notice,
or
but it's
the rumble
so
strip, but yes, tragedy
repetitive
too.
Repetitive and
yeah. Absolutely. So yeah, I think that kind of this whole chapter reminded me of that. This scene, right? Because you do, like, we're moving very slowly, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're drawn in, right? I think we all know who this is, and so it's not as captivating as perhaps would have been the first time you read it. Personally, yeah, I think about the highway. I think about driving like that, traveling like that. I do, however... also, you know, we drove out to go pumpkin patching the other weekend, and the drive was actually beautiful, right? I wasn't expecting to see the beauty that was there, and it was there. And it was actually, that ended up being my favorite part of the whole journey, as opposed to the destination and what we ultimately went out there for. And I think there's some of that. I can imagine the, like, these cliffs of the Emunmuil opening up after the Brownlands being an amazing sight, and also the Argonath and the Rorus. And then for this specifically, God, I'd just be creeped out. You know, I mean, you know, you're in this phase where you're sort of, the Germans have a word for it, sleep drunk. Right, you're literally like, I stood up the other night and almost fell over. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning, had to go to the bathroom, but stood up and sort of was like actually kind of wobbling because I was in this other place. And and then to see these sort of lamp like eyes, or to think that you've seen them,
do you have one, Matt, or I could go? I mean, I chose it.
Well, yeah, at first. So I didn't really, like, look ahead at what passage you had chosen until, you know, you read it. So when at first I heard it, it struck me as kind of an interesting pick. But now that we've discussed it, I think that this is a really apt passage for this chapter. Because it conveys Frodo's you know, it's not completely just boredom, but it's just fatigue and just, and there's an amount of boredom and like there's nothing to really like excite him or that he thinks he needs to urgently think about. And that's how I felt reading this chapter. Just like, and then all of a sudden, you know, something happens, of course. So, last week, my girlfriend's sister was in town visiting, and I think Friday night, or like very early Saturday morning, 2:30 in the morning, she was taking a bus to the airport. So the three of us were just going to like stay up until the 2 in the morning, and then we were going to walk down to the bus station so that she could get her bus at 2:30 in the morning. And at like 11 p.m., we'd started watching Stranger Things, actually, and we got a couple episodes into it, and these two were just like out. And I was still awake because I was, you know, I mean, Sean Astin's in this second season. So
the connection to Sam.
Yeah. Wanted to see. Yeah. So Samwise was in it. And I wanted to see what old Samwise was up to. And in the hours that follow that, they both decided that they were going to sleep until 1:30. And I decided that I was going to stay up. So I stayed up. But I like the goal was to make it to 1:30 because at 1:30 they were going to like wake up and someone was going to take a shower and like get ready to go. And 1:30 things were going to pick up. But I was just like by myself for several hours, basically in the dark with my phone to entertain me. And I was so bored. I was falling asleep. I wasn't even that tired. I didn't really have a reason to be tired, but sleep just sort of overcame me anyway. And I was worried that if I wasn't vigilant that, you know, despite the alarms that they had on their phones, that we would like miss the bus. But because I wanted to, you know, I'm gonna stay up just in case. But I kept like sort of nodding off, and I didn't ultimately go to sleep. Like I made it, but it was still really rough.
Yeah.
So that's what this, because you know you gotta stay awake, and it like staying up till 1:30 was never a challenge for me before in college.
Until
I had to, yeah. And I didn't have anything going on. Like if we were at a party or if I was like, you know, watching something interesting, but because I had nothing going on, I was just like being sucked into like sleep drunkenness, I guess. And it took its toll. So I know the feels in this case.
Know the feels. Yeah. I mean, you've touched on a lot of the like reasons why I did pick it, in the end and not over some other ones. When I first read over it, I just kind of glossed over it because like I knew it was Gollum too. But, you know, going back and trying to pick out a passage, like, I did like that idea, that sort of the temptation to fall asleep, to give in, and then something like this really creepy, terrible thing happened. Like, creature comes, like a bad thing happens. So, yeah, I mean, I was thinking of driving, too, as a personal response. It just came to mind, like, of course, like, soldiers are doing this. Tolkien the soldier probably had experience, like, having to, like, keep watch at some point, and that just gets really boring. I mean, other things that came to mind, like, that I assume, like, yeah, Tolkien might be drawing on here. I'm not sure how symbolic he wanted to get with this, but, like, with, like, Jesus and his disciples, like, keep watch, and, like, while he... Like, they're supposed to keep watch while he goes and prays, but they can't do it. They fall asleep. And there are a lot of times in the New Testament, it talks about, like, death is coming like a thief in the night, so therefore keep watch. So that's an important thing in the New Testament. And then, again, Tolkien the Catholic might have had that in mind when writing this passage. I suppose I ought to do a call to action then. I think we've all said something personal about it. Alice, Nate, did you have a particular personal reaction?
I did, actually. I only thought of this when I was listening to all of you guys. And this made me think of a time quite a few years ago. I was visiting Minnesota with a few friends, and we were watching a hockey game. And after the hockey game, we decided just to leave and go home. Well... It was like 10 p.m. when we left or whatever.
It was like a 4-hour
drive? It was like a 5-hour drive from where we were to get back home. And I was driving, and slowly but surely, of course, you know, there were five of us in the car, and every person started drifting off to sleep. And then I was the only one remaining awake. And unfortunately, eventually, I also dozed off at the wheel. and I woke up with a start. You know, someone might have said something, and we were kind of headed off the interstate to the, you know, off the right side. And, you know, I was startled, obviously, and I just sort of I jerked the wheel. It was winter. I don't know if there wasn't really snow, but, you know, there could have been just a little ice on the road or something like that. And we basically lost control and started swerving. And the interstate had some kind of construction going on, so that the left side of the road was just these concrete barriers. Mm-hmm. Like, there was no... You couldn't go into the shoulder median. Like, there was just a concrete barrier there, and we hit that pretty hard. And fortunately, you know, no one was hurt. It could have been a lot worse. But this made me think of that, and just, like, ever since then, being partly just terrified to drive at night, and partly... you know, if I ever am in a car and someone else is driving, if it's late at night, I will make a point to not fall asleep, because I know it is a very difficult position to be in if you are the only one driving, if you are the one driving and everyone else around you is sleeping not helping you in your task. So that's like, what that made me think of.
I feel like passengers almost have an obligation or to make sure that at least somebody's staying up to keep the driver company, because if you're alone driving, it's really easy to fall asleep. But if you have, like, one person that you're talking to, it's a huge difference in my experience.
Yeah.
So you called to stay awake, Matt?
Yes. Be ever vigilant. Not always, not ever, but, you know.
Yeah, that becomes taxing in its own way.
Yeah.
Rich?
Oh, I don't know. Sorry, we're all out of order.
Is that a call?
You know, I mean, I've had similar experiences. I hate driving. I don't hate driving. But I am... If I ever buy a car, like a new one, I hope it's going to be self-driving, because I don't trust humans. Yeah. But for me, I think it's sort of connected with the discussion we had last week. If we're talking about remaining vigilant, I think... More for me is about remaining vigilant about the memories and the things that I care about. You know, I just went to a friend's wedding up in Ottawa, and it's already as if it were a dream. You know, you land back home, and it's almost like no time passed at all.
But actually, you were there for a month.
Yeah, I was there definitely for longer than planned. There was a delay, but yeah. So to try to do what I can to safeguard those things that I think are important, which I think will take a lot of doing, but, you know, you can try. Stos?
So, I mean, I was thinking of those, of, like more on the symbolic level, and, like, the temptation to, like, become complacent and kind of in a rut, like... you know, spiritually, and, like, you need someone morally, or, you know, just self-centered or whatever, and, like, it's hard to keep watch alone, and, like, I think after this passage they do, like, they get someone in shotgun, like, I think that they get two people to keep watch after this incident, and I think that it's important to have someone else to keep watch with, like, so I would say in my life, like, Juliana helps, like, me to stay awake, and then I to help her stay awake. But it doesn't have to be, like, a significant other. Like, it can be, like, other friends that, like, keep you on track and, like, can keep you vigilant from falling into selfishness or moral decay or whatever.
I mean, it could just be complacency, too, right? Like, it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it can be all sorts of things. But, like, I would say... Yeah, what I had said.
Nate?
I don't know. This is probably going to sound cliche, but, you know, sometimes... So it's important to remain vigilant, as we've been saying, obviously, and wake up from your slumber, wake up from your complacency. But also, I think this passage is telling us, like, sometimes the most important things or the most dangerous things are not immediately visible. And so they might be hidden They, you know, they could be beneath the surface of something. So you also need to remain curious and open to, you know, going beyond the immediate, your immediate perceptions.
So we're going to move on to general discussion.
But first, we have to pick our random ass theme for the end of the episode.
Road rage, everybody.
Road rage. Perfect.
Yeah, that is perfect.
Okay. Right. So at the end of the episode, we will return to road rage. And because Stowes didn't have any lyric to work with in this chapter, he will guide us on our first topic for general discussion.
Yeah. I'd like to talk about Boromir. Poor Boromir wanted to go to Minas Tirith, and he's not sure if anyone wants to go with him. But he wants to be true to the men of Minas Tirith. Like the men of Minas Tirith, he is true, and he will not abandon his comrades. Well, until a little bit later, at least. I was wondering if you guys made anything of that scene, or have ever felt like Boromir, or I don't know.
I don't know. I didn't think he came across very good here. What did you guys think? He came across as a jerk to me, but...
But it's still hard. He wants to go home, like, and
it's not
and
just
help his people out.
Yeah, it's he feels bound, right, to the responsibilities that he has at the home front. And those are some serious responsibilities, and one assumes that he's, you know, getting a lot of pressure from all sides, from within, from above, and then this odd mission to destroy the ring, which he thinks, probably according to the lore of Gondor, is sort of like a gift from on high that could solve their problems.
Yeah.
I always used to read him as kind of like a selfish character, or he only had his own interests in mind, but I don't think that's really true so much anymore. And I think he really thinks he knows he wants to do what's best for, you know, the party and probably for the world. He just has a totally different understanding of what would be, you know, best for everybody and how to actually go about that.
Yeah, but along
the way, he seems
to be
a little misguided in that.
And a little querulous.
Yes, that's true.
Yes.
Quite. And he's also, I mean, and it's also, no one else is really taking his side. It's like him against the company, and that's not a good feeling.
I think he's really frustrated that they don't see things remotely his way.
Right.
Yeah, and he reveals himself to be a sort of one-trick pony, I think. On page 389, he says, "But the enemy holds the eastern bank." And it's so there, he's like regressing to this sort of notion of war and positioning and strategery, as some people would say. Right. And I think that's Boromir, right? He knows sort of one thing, and that is fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't understand the sort of, I think, broader implications and the finesse that might be involved in the mission that the rest of this company finds himself on.
But I also think it's clear that he doesn't agree with the fundamental purpose of the quest. He's at odds with what they're doing. I mean, their goal is to destroy the ring, and I think it's pretty clear that he would rather use the ring for Gondor.
And he's been that way since, you know, the Council of Elrond.
Yes.
He expressed that view.
And, like, he starts getting pretty weird, and, like, he's getting close to Frodo, and he's trying to, like, look at Frodo's face up close at times. He, you know...
And Aragorn's.
Right. And Aragorn's, and he's, like, biting his nails nervously as everyone else is just kind of half asleep going down this river.
Mm-hmm.
He's just, like, a nervous wreck out there. So there's something eating him inside.
Yes. Yes. And for that reason, I think there is some sympathy that I have with him, because it's, I don't think it's very simple what's going on.
No, he's struggling.
We're led to believe that he is wrong in his and his thoughts and ideas about what to do with this ring.
At some point, I thought we could touch on the whole Aragorn becoming, or, you know, Strider mm-hmm. becoming Aragorn / LSR thing.
A litany of names, if you will.
That's yet another incarnation of the whole, like, Aragorn's nickname problem that keeps coming up. Like, he's Strider to some people, he's Aragorn. Now he's Aragorn to Frodo, too.
Yeah, he's been Aragorn for the past few chapters, it seems like, but then on page 393, Frodo turned and saw Strider, and yet not Strider, for the weather-worn ranger was no longer there. In the stern sat Aragorn, son of Arathorn, proud and erect, guiding the boat with skillful strokes. His hood was cast back, and his dark hair blowing in the wind. A light was in his eye.
Yeah, I thought this was a good passage, but kind of strange, too, because he saw Strider and yet not Strider. And it's like, this isn't the first time that we've seen Aragorn sort of revealed as he is, his true nature, his true self.
Mm-hmm.
We, like, and Frodo has seen it, too. You know, he saw it at Rivendell, and he probably saw it in Moria as Aragorn is fighting off their enemies, and I'm sure he saw it in Lorien, you know, when he's conversing in Elvish. You know, he obviously knows all these people. He's spent time there. He's friends with them. And, like, he has been the leader of their company since Gandalf fell. So it's not really the first time. So I just thought it was a strange flashback to Strider.
Yeah, it did seem sort of out of place, but I think the point is to remind the reader, you know, how we first perceived Aragorn. And that's, we had this discussion just before we started recording, is whether or not the others see this change at this moment, or whether Frodo, by dint or gift of, you know, his, you know, newly acquired sight, for lack of a better term, sees for a moment this change in Strider, nay, Aragorn's demeanor. We don't know, because, you know, we see this through Frodo's eyes, supposedly. But my guess is he still looks like Strider.
Literally.
Literally still looks like Strider.
And we're far from Lorien in Rivendell, and it's been several days. Like, even though he's been revealed, like, a couple of times. And now, what? And I'm not sure if all the company, like, saw him like that. Like, he, like, seemed like an elf lord. Like, it may not have been always obvious, and it may not be obvious here.
Yeah, I mean, the other moments were, even in this moment, we're seeing it through Frodo's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know how the others see him necessarily, but, you know, maybe they all look kind of rough and grizzled right now. They've gone 10 days since Lorien. They've just been going
all
down the river.
All of their stuff is wet.
Wet.
From rain or from river.
Supposed to be uncomfortable.
River water.
They're stiff in the limbs, probably.
Yeah. So they probably don't look a sight, if you will. But in this moment, you know, he sort of, like, I don't know, he probably has this light on him. You know, the light of kings or something like that. So for a brief moment, you know, he looks clean and whole and mighty.
And hail, perhaps? No?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, hail.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, so one last thing we have on our list up there is the return of the ring wraith?
Big question mark. Yeah. I mean, not really, but... So what page are we on?
So that's on page 387.
388 commentary.
Yeah, so... Frodo looked up at the elf, Legolas, tall above him, as he gazed into the night. His head was dark, crowned with sharp white stars that glittered in the black pools of the sky behind. Well, I was wondering if that was like a comparison to Durin, actually.
We've seen a crown of stars before.
Yeah.
Well.
But also, so Frodo is sort of feeling this pain, that reminding him of the wound that was healed in Rivendell. So one assumes that it's a ring wraith, and
there's the chill, the deadly cold.
Right.
Even, that's always associated with him.
Even as he did so, a dark shape like a cloud, and yet not a cloud, for it moved far more swiftly, came out of the blackness in the south and sped toward the company, blotting out all light as it approached. Soon it appeared a great winged creature, blacker than the pits in the night. So there's some talk of maybe the Balrog?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, they speculate.
Yeah, and then they say, I can't remember who says, no, something much worse.
Frodo shuts it down. He says, it was not a Balrog.
Yeah.
It was something colder. I think it was, and then he doesn't complete his thought, and Boromir looks at him very creepily.
It's like when you name the thing, it'll appear. Like, it's sort of a feeling. Like, yeah, I don't think he wants to name it.
Right, but do we think that this is the eagle that we've talked
about?
No.
Well,
we don't know.
Well,
usually I wouldn't think an eagle would be described in this way. It's so dark and blacker than the pits in the night.
And it's, I mean, it's just casting a shadow, so it's large.
Yeah, but there's so much, like, ring-wraithy language, like the memory of an old wound in his shoulder.
But the winged creature...
The creature, though.
We don't know is the ring-wraith, right?
No, like, that's why it's foreshadowing.
Right, so we don't know that it's not the ring-wraith on an eagle.
Right, oh, but true. The ring-wraith would not... Right. Yeah, we don't know what this creature is, but I think we can say it's not an eagle. The eagles are usually
say it's not an eagle.
The eagles are associated with the good guys.
So are horses. In any case, Legolas shoots whatever it is down.
And whatever it is, Legolas kills it.
Yeah.
Yep.
And he sighs, Elbereth Gilthoniel.
I thought that was interesting too.
Yeah, there's an exclamation point, but he sighed.
Yeah, because it's still a sort of interjection. It's just not shouted. It's like an invocation, maybe.
Yeah.
It's like, oh God.
You know when you're, if you've ever biked, in a very
bickin,
yes, thank you, in a very like cold wind, and you get a gust of. Like glacially cold wind that goes right down your throat, and it,
and you go, mother,
it takes your breath away.
Elbereth Gilthoniel.
So maybe like this chill is just like, his lungs have almost collapsed in this chill, and he's like, he can't. This is a shout. It should be a shout.
Yes.
Although it was Frodo who felt the chill.
Yes.
I don't know that they all felt cold.
And if he would have shouted, that might have drawn more attention from the orcs across the way, too.
Mm-hmm. So
the fact that it's Frodo who... What?
Elvish policy is to shoot first and find out what it is later.
I know, right? What if it was like an Amazon drone?
Trying to deliver, like, some message from Elrond.
Delivering more Mithril. Amazon Prime.
That's not a random theme, Matt.
No, I know. That should be, though.
More arrows, because he's going to run out at some point.
But the company seems to think that whatever it is dead, and we can only presume that a ring wraith isn't dead, right?
Right. Yeah, but it's... I mean, their horses have been killed, so maybe Legolas killed whatever. Yep. they do say, like, well... Our enemies are dismayed, so it can't be like a bad thing that we shot.
Oh, right. Yeah. So, yeah.
Sure. Whatever it was, its fall has dismayed our enemies. So it seems, said Aragorn.
Yeah.
All right.
So let's hit some road rage.
All right.
Boromir's got it.
Yeah.
So road rage is like an indicator of some other ailment or torment or something.
Yeah.
Some deeper emotional issue.
Mm-hmm.
Is Boromir manifesting road rage like symptoms?
He's tailgating.
He is tailgating.
He's just getting awkwardly close.
Yeah, questioning everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this point where he actually bumps into Aragorn's boat. Yeah. Hoy there, Aragorn. This is madness.
Well, that's because Aragorn's out of his reckoning,
Yes.
And runs them a rock, a shoal.
That's true. They end up in the rapids much sooner than planned. But
because he was tailgating.
Because he was tailgating, exactly.
Was he tailgating at this point?
Probably.
Well, there were no other collisions here.
Yeah.
This is the only one.
Yeah. Fair.
Okay.
I see.
This is a great analysis.
the at least possibility of a tailgate incident.
Yep.
Any other tailgators going on?
All the drivers in DC. I don't know. No. Oh, Gollum.
Gollum too close.
Gollum's not tailgating. He's being very cautious.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But Frodo saw him fairly close.
Well, I'm not sure.
He puts his hand on the boat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's. I don't think it's Gollum's sort of whatever point to stay hidden. He wants the ring.
Yeah.
And he I think he knows he can get away.
Yeah. Right?
So he's got to get close to get it.
Okay.
And he probably recognizes the sword.
Yeah.
Mm. Like a hobbit drawing that sword. It's like, hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe the ring wraith has a little road rage. Had so much road rage that he decided to get a flying whatever.
Well, yeah. The thing is, he's going to have a lot more road rage now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. True that. Yeah.
Yeah, he's just, like, going to be really pissed. Because, I mean, his car keeps getting wrecked.
Yeah.
You know, every time he gets a nice car, it just gets wrecked.
So go back to Mordor, get a new vehicle.
Yeah.
Sure. And he's probably got to ask for it in such a way that it's not pleasant.
Not going to work out.
Greetings, it's your evilness.
Yeah. He's got to go back home and talk to his parents and explain how he wrecked the car again.
Yeah.
And what about the Ugh. They probably have plenty of rage while they're on the road.
Probably.
It seems they're on foot, though.
Right, but I presume they're on
They're on a path.
Yeah,
a road.
They're on the road, right?
Yes.
Hmm. They probably wouldn't use their turn signals.
The company has a good safety feature. Like, they have special protective cloaks and... And their boats maybe are, you know, they're well made. They're made with love. And so that defeats the malice of the arrows of Mordor.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. We didn't hear too much about Merry and Pippin in this chapter, do we?
That they were uncomfortable at Boromir's driving and behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good aspect.
They seem
because they're
redundant.
Just like the, you know, they're the poor companions in this vehicle. And have you ever been in a car when the driver has a lot of road rage? That's uncomfortable.
Yeah. It is.
And they're just like sitting in like the way back seat. They have no say in what's going on.
Well, you don't want to say anything because it's
just
going to make it worse.
The two people in the front seat are arguing, bumping into each other.
Yeah.
Metaphorically, but. But the kids in the back are just along for the ride, for better or worse.
Yeah, if they had been backseat drivers here, you know, things could have got pretty ugly, I think, with Boromir.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Boromir is not about to be told what to do by some hobbits.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. Okay, so that was Road Rage.
Next week,
we
have the final chapter of The Fellowship of the Ring.
The
breaking of the fellowship.
Yep.
Literally.
That's ominous.
Yeah.
That's ominous.
It is. And after that, maybe we'll do a sort of
a recap?
Recap episode where we talk about interesting themes and just look at things in closer detail than we really got a chance to during the individual episodes.
Mm-hmm.
So stay tuned for that.
Right. And if you would like to write us until then.
So send us an email at thetolkienheads@gmail.com. You can go to our Facebook, The Tolkien Heads, and of course we're at thetolkienheads.com is where we upload all of our podcasts, but you can also get them directly from iTunes.
Mm-hmm. And you could maybe help us get Stephen Colbert to give us a call back. I don't know. If you've got connections, let us know.
Please, Stephen, we're waiting for you.
All right, so until next week, we have been
the Tolkien Heads.